Thank you. This is work that has been done at the University of Queensland and also in collaboration with Harvard University. There's a cast of, well, twice as many people as you think there is. But in particular, the heavy experimental and theoretical lifting was done by Ben Lanyon and James Whitfield. It was funded by the Australian and US governments through various schemes. And in the next 30 minutes or so, I'll take you through simulating quantum systems, how we do it, which is photonic quantum computing, and then we'll look at, as the title says, first steps and prospects. It really is a delight to be here. I was at the last CQIQC conference as well, and I was wanting to ring up Daniel and thank him for the invitation. Couldn't remember his phone number, so I typed into Google Daniel James Quantum, and yes, you got Daniel James at the University of Toronto, which you would expect. But then the next 50 things, or 49 at least, in Google were the Quantum of Solace, Daniel Craig, James Bond. And it made me realise I should have spotted this years ago. If you think about it, they've got the same colour hair, same colour eyes, they're both British, they both dress impeccably. One of them takes the Quantum of Solace, the other one has the Solace of Quantum. Except according to Google, wait for it, Daniel's better. Now, I rang Daniel up to point this out to him and I said, did you ever think there'd be a universe where you ranked above James Bond? And there's a pause and then they're very offended, and what would your point be? So, but I realised that if they're using this kind of technique, this explains the research success for CQIQC, because it made me think a little bit about perhaps how they do their graduate exams for their PhD students. So if you bear with me for just 20 seconds.
She let you go?
I answered your questions. I told you what you wanted to know about quantum.
Yes, you did.
So we'll stop it there. The final thing is, he said, I told you everything you wanted to know about quantum, and he says, you did. Now, if you're taking that exam, how do you think the next step's going to go? And if you are doing a PhD here, just remember, it doesn't matter how bad your quals or final exams are, they could be a lot worse. All right, so enough of that. Let's look at simulating quantum systems. So Richard Feynman, of course, kicked this off with a lovely article back in 1982 where he pointed out one of the real problems in quantum mechanics is simulating those systems on classical computers. It's hopeless because as you scale up Schrodinger's equation, the number of equations you need grows exponentially with the number of particles. So he had the thought that, well, perhaps this might be a good thing to use quantum systems as quantum computational building blocks. And I know a lot of people cite this paper, but if you haven't, go back and read it. It's amazingly ahead of its time. It doesn't actually provide an answer, but it provides a lot of really stimulating questions. So really nothing much was done with that insight for quite a few years until a paper by Seth Lloyd in 1996, and he showed the following, that you could start with some initial wave function with some number of qubits that only grows polynomially with the number of particles that you're trying to simulate, send it through some evolution where if you're using quantum logic gates, again, they only grow polynomially with the number of particles, and at the output, you'll get some approximation to the quantum evolution you were trying to model. And that's great, and so what he really showed was that Feynman was correct for a very large class of physical quantum systems. And in fact, to turn it around, there are some now theorists who are discussing a kind of belief that if you can't model a quantum system this way, it's not physical. I don't know how that will go. But from an experimental point of view, that's great. But how can we use that to learn about physical properties? And as Steve Flamir already mentioned this morning, Alanis Borugutsik has done a lot of work in showing that you can take this and adapt it to learn things about chemical, physical systems of interest. In this case, for example, energy of a molecule using the so-called iterative phase estimation problem, which turns an eigenvalue estimation problem into a phase estimation problem. And as we know from previous work on Shor's algorithm and several other things, phase estimation is something we can do very well in quantum information. He's also shown you can do a bunch of other things, but I'll say more about that in the next couple of slides. So it's time for Quantum Chemistry 101. These slides have been kindly provided to me by Alan, so any mistakes are mine, not his. The problem in quantum chemistry is you take some atom that you're wanting to look at and associate into a molecule, and you ignore the kinetic energy, and you just map out a potential. And you want to find the energy as a function of really just the only inputs are the number of electrons and the nuclear coordinates, and you want to get an output as energy. And when you do that, and people can do this classically, they get these kind of potential energy maps as a function of the nuclear coordinates. And this is useful because things on the maps, for example, that point there is an equilibrium position describing the CO molecule, carbon dioxide molecule. This point here is a transition thing to some other state. You can calculate reaction rates and mechanisms. And I'm told that such maps characterize most of physical chemistry. Where it breaks down is for very fast things, or for example, as you go towards condensed matter, where of course you need a whole different suite of techniques. So that's Quantum Chemistry 101. In 102, you start seeing, well, how do you solve it? And you use a classical computer. There's an exact algorithm, which they know, but it scales exponentially in a classical computer. And so there's an entire tree, and this is adapted by a figure from Jim Anderson, of various approximations and techniques you can use to get polynomial scaling. But they're approximations. So the quantum simulation approach is you'll take the wave function in Hamiltonian that you're wanting to study and map it onto another quantum system, in our case a quantum computer, and the idea is that you'll be able to get an exact solution with only polynomial scaling. And we keep hearing about the first green shoots of recovery. Well, perhaps this is the first green shoots of quantum emulation. Here's why you would do this. It's known that for factoring and search, you get an exponential advantage for factoring, a square root advantage for search. But for this configuration interaction approach in quantum chemistry, you get an exponential advantage. For chemical dynamics, you get an exponential advantage. For molecular properties, you get an advantage that scales as D, which I'm told is significant. And they've even started looking recently at protein folding, which is known to be an exponentially difficult problem. They haven't shown yet that they'll get an advantage, but they feel they're on the way. So that's enough for us as an experimentalist to start saying, well, what's the smallest possible system we could build to start testing this? And the simplest molecule you can think of is hydrogen. Here you go, two atoms. We're going to make them as simple as possible. There's one electron in each atom. We're going to combine them into molecular orbitals in kind of the standard undergraduate fashion, and you end up with six basis states. So if you take those six basis states and put them in a Hamiltonian, due to symmetries, you end up with three 2x2 matrices. So you really only have to solve for these 2x2 matrices, not a 6x6. And because they're in different blocks with no coherences between them, there's three different blocks you have to solve. This is a well-known problem. This is a photo of Dirac in front of, you know, the problem from a long time ago, and this is basically what Dirac would have done, except what he wouldn't have done is this next step, which is take the Hamiltonian and map it onto a bunch of unitary evolutions. So what does that look like in the lab? Well, in general, the iterative phase estimation algorithm looks as the following. You have a control qubit, an eigenstate which is encoded into many qubits, and I'll come back to that at the end of the talk, how different ways of doing that. There's a time evolution gate where the structure of the gate can change depending on readout, where you read out one bit at a time. So when you want to read out the first bit of the answer, you have a certain value for the gate here. Second bit of the answer, you change that gate and so on. And this is why it's called iterative. That has polynomial scaling. Hydrogen's the simplest case. So the question becomes, how do you build, for experimentalists, this controlled 2x2 unitary operator? So this is going to take me then into a smaller side on photonic quantum computing. We've already heard about it this morning from the third speaker. We need photons. We use spontaneous down conversion. Here we have a high energy photon sent through a nonlinear crystal every now and then, somewhere between 1 time and 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 8, depending on the system. One of the photons splits into two lower energy photons, and accounting for the crystal, it conserves energy and momentum. If I detect a photon and say that path there, then I know with a very high probability there's one photon in the other path, but it's not perfect. There's also a small chance of there being two or more photons. And this is very well understood. We know very well how the optics of these systems look. We know how to couple them into single mode fibers. In terms of brightness over 12 years, they've come up seven orders of magnitude. So we're at the point where that is not the limiting factor in experiments now. Other issues are. Except that, of course, they're now so bright that this two-photon term is starting to come up and cause errors. So that's how you get your photon. To encode information onto the qubit, you can use any degree of freedom of the optical field. People most often use polarization encoding for the two quantum levels, but you can equally use spatial encoding. Path encoding is used. In fact, we'll be hearing about that this afternoon from the Bristol group. Temporal encoding, frequency encoding, all of this has been used. It doesn't matter what you use, as long as you can make a coherent superposition of the two quantum levels. In the case of polarization, that's very easy. And single qubit gates are very easy. You can just use wave plates to do any arbitrary single qubit gate. Two qubit gates are hard because you need one photon to affect the state of another. In fact, to affect the polarization of another. And that's well beyond, well, nonlinear optics at the moment. It was first suggested, in fact, by Gerard Milburn back in 1988. And he and Barry Sanders applied for an Australian Research Council project to explore this idea some more. They got back a referee's report that was just wonderful. It said, if you fund only one project in Australia this year, make sure it's not this one. It was just seen as science fiction, and it really was many years ahead of its time. However, fortunately, since then, things have changed a little bit. There's now a whole table, this is very briefly, a table of different proposals to have one photon influence the state of another. There's the original one using strong non-linearities. There's something called a linear optical approach known as KLM. There's also ones with interaction-free measurement, quantum Zeno effect, amplified weak non-linearities, a new one called geometric phase in Hilbert space. We're only today going to be looking at this top one, linear optical. Each of those others you could do a whole separate talk on. So in the linear optical, here's Camille Flammer Milburn here. They came up with the following idea that you would send photonic qubits through a linear optical network and they would come out looking entangled as long as you allowed yourself the option of ancilla single photon detection and fast feed forward. And then that was scalable with some overhead where the sum was too much. Demonstration gates have been done, and in terms of all the quantum computing architectures, the fastest gate times have been achieved with these photon gates at Vienna. I'll also point out that, John Rarity pointed out that photons have very long decoherence times. If you look at the cosmic microwave background, it's partially polarized, so he figures photons in free space are good for about 15 billion years. What has been done in the lab between two islands and the Canary Islands is the polarization information was maintained over 141 kilometers. Okay, it'll be different in free space, in solid state. Okay, so if we wanted to build a two-qubit gate, this is just one way to convince you that this idea of the linear optics might work. If I wanted to have a control qubit, two rails here, 0 and 1, change the phase, say, of the 0 on a target qubit, I could use a nonlinearity, except none such exist. But I can get away with three one-third beam splitters and achieve a similar kind of a result. So, for example, if the two photons come in as shown and reflect off the mirrors, their amplitude is, probability amplitude is one-third of what it was. Well, there's nothing very surprising there. That's classical optics. On the other hand, if they come in and meet at the central beam splitter, and the beam splitter has a reflectivity eta, there's two amplitudes. They can both be transmitted, which is 1 minus eta, or they can both be reflected, which is eta. In our case, eta equals a third, so that means the amplitude is negative one-third. So it's the same overall magnitude as before, but it has the phase shift that we're after. So if we were to turn that from, say, polarization coding into path encoding with beam splitters as shown, then in the instances where the two photons come out here, you've achieved the entangling operation. It's non-deterministic, so it's not guaranteed that the two photons will come out one in each mode as shown. And in fact, there's a tremendous entire body of work on how you take that into the scalable regime. But for our purposes here, we're just going to look at what we can simulate using this. The very first experiment like this was done back in 2003. Here it is, taking up a lot of table space. And the problem is, if you think about it, we heard this morning in Steve's talk, you will need hundreds of qubits to do something interesting. Hundreds of things this size will end up being kind of Borg-sized labs. I don't even want to think what the Australian Research Council will ask if I ask for funding for that. So we, like many other groups, and being led, in fact, by Bristol around the world, are miniaturizing. A different way of doing this, and I'm just showing you this because we need to see how it works for the what we actually did in the lab, is you come in with your control and target qubits in polarization, But now the interaction region is a partially polarizing beam splitter, where you get one-third reflectance, say, for the horizontal, but perfect reflectance for the visible. And then that does that nonlinear, that beam splitter operation there. You add two more beam splitters to get the other beam splitters. And this has some advantages in that there's no interferometers, so you don't have to worry about dual path. It has some disadvantages. If the manufacturer lies about what they give you there, you're stuck with it. But there's ways to work around that. So we've already heard this morning about state tomography, so I don't have to say very much about it. For polarization, it's very well known to optics people that you measure Stokes parameters, you know the polarization of the field. For two photons, you just measure the biphoton Stokes parameters. And as we heard this morning, it blows up exponentially. For process tomography, say I'm starting with a horizontally polarized photon, this is the Poincaré sphere. If nothing happens to it, that's the identity process. If it goes to right, it's like a sigma x. From there to diagonal, sigma z, and from there back to the original, sigma y. That's for a single qubit. And again, I can take pairwise combinations of that and get two-qubit process tomography. It has an even worse exponential scaling. When you do this, the states and processes you get are unphysical. You then have to find a way to get them to be a better estimate of what happens, and people use either Bayesian analysis or maximum likelihood techniques. The output, as we saw in the third talk, is you can write the process ideally as that, but what you really want to have is a visual representation of what's going on. So for example, we use a chi matrix, which is the same way that a density matrix is a table of state measurement outcomes and the coherences between them. You can regard a chi matrix as a table of measurement probabilities and the coherences between them. The ideal chi matrix, for example, might look like this. This term here, for example, is the IX term. So identity to one qubit and X rotation to the other, and the off-diagonals are coherences. That's what we measure in the lab. They look kind of similar, so you can start putting numbers on them. The average gate fidelity, for example. And we get average gate fidelities, these are old data now, 90 to 94%. But if one gate works 90 to 95% of the time, then two gates should work at best 80 to 90% of the time. And I want you to keep those numbers in mind because we're going to run these gates 20 times in a row. Okay. All of that's very nice, but it doesn't give you a controlled unitary, which is the thing we actually need to do some quantum chemistry. So this is some work that was done, again, by Ben Lanyon and Marco Barbieri at the University of Queensland. It appeared earlier this year. And it's a cute little trick for achieving gates that otherwise are hard to achieve, and it'll work in any architecture, not just photons. So say you wanted to do a Toffoli gate. That's naturally a three-body interaction. They don't occur very naturally, so it's been known for a long time. If you look it up in Mike and Ike, Nilsson and Chuang, you can make it up with six CNOT gates, for example. How does that scale? Well, if you wanted to go to four-qubit Toffoli, or an n-qubit Toffoli, it scales as n squared. And the controlled unitary which we're wanting to make has the same scaling. So it's been known for a while that there was a better technique than that, and in this better technique the scaling went linearly with the number of qubits, but it needed n minus 1 n silla qubits. So that's not great for the lab because, you know, experimentalists are lazy. So we looked around, talked to some theorists, including Alexei Gilchrist and Tim Routh, and they pointed out that there's a new technique we can use where you change the target from a qubit into a qdit, isolate some of the quantum information while you act on some of it in the other rails of the qdit, and then recombine it. And this gives you 2n scaling. Of course, it's easy to write that down as a mathematical operation. How do you do it? Well, that depends on the details of the physical system. In the case of photons, we've got non-deterministic gates, so our way of transforming it from a qubit into a qdit and back again is using polarizing beam splitters. It's a handy trick. If you wanted to do a triple controlled Toffoli with this, you only need to nest this twice. If you wanted to do a doubly controlled unitary, you only need to nest this twice. If you wanted to do a triply controlled unitary and k qubits, you only need to nest this twice. I hope a trend is becoming clear. We only did it once. That's what we're wanting to build in the lab. If you want to do the controlled unitary, you just drop off that top rail and emit a gate. So that's easy to do. What it looks like is this: the polarizing beam splitters are these calcite beam displacers, the entangling gates are these partially polarizing beam splitters I talked about earlier, and we ran it. For a Toffoli, we've got a truth table that is kind of similar performance to the truth table achieved in ions for a Toffoli also earlier this year. For the Toffoli, we've got entangled outputs as we would expect, but let's get to the controlled unitary, which is the thing we're interested in. These are the process matrices We did rotations by an angle of theta around the z-axis. So when the angle is pi and 4, this is known as a T-gate. So this is a controlled T-gate. These are the real and imaginary parts of the process matrix. When theta is pi and 2, it's a J-gate. So this is a controlled J-gate. When theta is 3 pi and 4, it had no name, so we called it an L-gate after the first author, and he hasn't quite forgiven us. And when it's theta equals pi, it's a Z-gate. And the fidelity for these operations is very high, somewhere between 94 and 98%. So we know we can do this operation very well. Take-home message from this little section is this will work for any quantum architecture where you can transform qubits into qubits and back again. It's not just a photon trick. Let's move on to the quantum chemistry. So we wanted to do this circuit for the simplest case of hydrogen. Well, it turns out the simplest case is one control qubit, and we only need one qubit to encode the molecular wave function, which, remember, we're encoding as a binary string, so we only need two photons from down conversion. This gate we can use using the trick I just talked about. And what we're trying to achieve, this is the mathematical, this is from a 50-bit MATLAB code of the ground state for molecular hydrogen as a function of distance in atomic units. So this is one and a bit atomic units here. That's the theoretical calculation. That's what we achieved with the 20-bit iterative phase estimation algorithm. So it's quite close. In fact, if you zoom in, they agree to within 6 microhartrees. A hartree is a unit of energy that the chemists use because they don't know what joules are. So that's about one part in 100,000. In fact, we did it for the ground and first three excited states. And at this stage, people should be very, very suspicious, because I spent quite a bit of the talk saying one gate works 90 to 95% of the time. These gates work by iterating something 20 times. This shouldn't work anywhere near this well. So what's going on? And what's going on is it didn't work perfectly, but we used just a classical error correction technique, majority vote. So for example, if I look at, say, I don't know, bit 19 here, 10 of the runs gave me a logical 1, 20 of the runs gave me a logical 0, so we just took a logical vote and said, majority vote, and said it's a logical 0. And we did that for every bit. So in other words, there was a small overhead of 30 runs per bit to give us this behaviour, and it worked. If I'll now look at the probability for obtaining the ground state energy at the bond length, okay? And if you only run it once, if you only take one sample per bit, that probability is just over 20%, and that turns out to be there's a 93% probability of success per bit, and we iterate it 20 times, so that drops. But as you increase the iterations per bit, that's just two iterations per bit and so on, you can see this quickly saturates, so you always end up with 100% probability of success in this majority vote technique. And we picked 30 because it seemed to be well into the saturation regime. But that told us that we didn't have to go, for example, to 70 or something like that. Were we limited to 20 bits of precision? No, basically we got bored. And to show you that was the case, if we only extract one bit, of course, you get 90-something percent operation. And as you extract more and more bits, this is without majority vote, your probability drops exponentially. So by the time we went up to, I think, 47 or so bits of accuracy, you had very little chance of it working. But of course, you can always do majority vote and amplify that up to 100%. So we could have, for the full experiments, gone well beyond 20 bits. We didn't need to, because that one part in 100,000 is something known as chemical precision. So as long as we were at chemical precision, we were matching what is currently done in quantum chemistry. That looks kind of nice. Will it work for arbitrary cases? And the answer is no. It turns out in our particular system we had some very nice symmetries that meant we could use the same 2x2 qubit unitary for every iteration. We only had to change some settings within the gate. But in general, you'll need completely different circuits. This will give you different error characteristics. And then, of course, you'll need full quantum error correction. So this will only work up to a point. We also looked at what happens if this input state is corrupted. So in the case where the input state has perfect fidelity with the ideal, 100%, as before, we get about 20% probability of the algorithm succeeding. And you'll see this drops, but it drops very gracefully. So down to 50%, there's still a non-zero chance of it working. And then if we do the majority vote technique, we can amplify that up even so that if we say it's 70% input fidelity, which is lousy, we've got 100% chance of the thing working. So we were a little surprised by this result. We weren't expecting it to be quite so robust to input state noise. But that's kind of hopeful because experimentalists like things where noise is allowable. Okay, so what next? Where we are today is we've done this, but as, well, what was Steve Lemire's thing this morning? Anything under 10 qubits is cute but useless. So that made me think of this, baby with an abacus, that's cute but useless. What we need to do is move into the useful region. And we have theory collaborators at Harvard who really quite clearly identify that if we can get to systems of a few hundred qubits, they can start modeling benzene and caffeine and cholesterol. And that one's particularly important because you can get medical funding at that point. I could finish the talk there, but it would be a little bit like these two guys in the famous Steve Harris cartoon, complicated math, then a miracle occurs, more complicated math. I think you should be more explicit here in step two. So in the next two slides, let me be a little bit more explicit about what we see as the road ahead. The first thing is we need to do every part of the algorithm in a scalable way. At the moment, the only thing we did in a scalable way was this control gate. In that, we did the iterative phase estimation algorithm, but we did it in a lab system that isn't scalable. But the quantum logic is being done scalably. What we didn't do was an adiabatic technique to efficiently prepare the eigenstates, and there's methods known to do that, but we used a classical approximation for that, and something called Lloyd's approximation technique to implement that in a more general way, and I want to discuss that in the next two slides. So say I have a Hamiltonian that consists of three qubits. I'll number them. There you go, one, two, three. And each of them has an interaction as shown, one, two, two, three, three, one. Well, I can add each of those individual Hamiltonians to get a master Hamiltonian for the system and simulate evolution of that entire thing. That's uncontroversial and well known. But the problem is if I take each of those individual Hamiltonians and turn them into individual unitaries, I don't get the unitary that is equivalent to that. This breaks. The solution is what we think of as slice and dice. You take each of these unitaries, red, blue, green, and cut them into small time bursts and do them out for as long as you need to get the precision you're after. So in the case of having those infinitely thin for an infinite time, you get perfect approximation. But we don't need perfect, we only need about one part in 10,000 or 100,000. What will these actual gates look like, these unitary evolutions? Well, our collaborators at Harvard worked them out for all the elements of chemical interest. So for example, the single and double excitation operators for a molecule, the excitation operator, the Coulomb and exchange operators, they have a logic gate mapping for all of those now. So it's now known there's a path to do this if the experimentalists just, what's the phrase he used? Pull their fingers out. What if we wanted to do hydrogen, which you just did, in a more scalable way? Well, the good news is it'll take 6 qubits, and that's kind of believable. The bad news is it'll take some gates where some is 200 to 1400. And in particular, by the time you get to about 600 gates, you're getting an appropriate level of chemical precision. This is the error in your energy versus the number of gates. But at least we have a scaling path for this. So let's look at the conclusions for the talk. I guess the first take-home message is yes, the first molecular quantum simulation has been done on a quantum computer. The next thing is, and I'm really dreading saying this, jet-lagged, don't throw out your classical computational quantum chemistry cluster just yet. This isn't really going to change how quantum chemists are doing their jobs today, but it might change how their students are doing their jobs in 20 years. So what next? Well, we're going to start playing with some other funkier algorithms, keep going with quantum chemistry, starting to look at photosynthesis, and of course on the purely technical front, to get more qubits and to get them in a better way, we're looking at things like integrated photonic circuits, that's a collaboration with Macquarie University, photon number resolving detectors, using those to make compact sources of heralded photons. For those PhD students who are suffering under the James Bond regime here at Toronto, please come join us in Queensland. We have slightly different examination conditions. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Thank you.